Hello, friends. I don't really like to break into what must be for all of us a very powerful silence, a very powerful time for us to meditate on what has happened over the last 3 or 4 days. Personally, I found it very difficult to think of anything else. I started putting notes together for this talk a few days ago. Then the skies fell in with the invasion, and it seemed that everything that I planned to say would be pretty trivial compared with these events. I wondered whether I should change tack, but I found that I didn't really know what I could say or what I would want to say in such circumstances. So I'm going to stick with Quakers and the secular world. And thank you, William, for that very pertinent quote from John Donne. No man is an island entire to itself, for whom the bell tolls, those bells in those beautiful churches in Kyiv and Moscow. When the bell tolls, it tolls for me, and it tolls for you. I'm going to begin with an apology. I'm a writer. My world is words. So it's been a strange experience to find that as I approach my 87th birthday, words are beginning to desert me. They kind of disappear just at the time when you want it. Names, well, I've been forgetting names for years, but now it's not just names, it's words, any old words, familiar words. Alan Bennett told a story about his elderly mother pointing to a flock of sheep and saying, "Look at them there. I know what they are, but I can't think what they're called." Well, Mrs. Bennett, I've caught up with you. What's it and thingy-bob are my salvation. But I don't want to inflict my senior moments on you. So I can only apologize for the fact that I'm going to be reading from a written text, at least when a key word wouldn't come as I stared into my laptop. I could give it time or just find another one. Finding an alternative word is actually quite interesting. You often find yourself saying something quite different from what you intended, something more interesting. Why have I chosen to talk about Quakers and the secular world? Not because I have anything particularly wise or new to say, but because the tension between the religious and the secular has intrigued me ever since Ben Pink's Pink Dandelions Swarthmore lecture in 2014. When he spoke of modern liberal Quakerism as infected by secularism, prey to the secularization of Western society, in peril of becoming a mere secular pressure group. Infected, a prey, a peril. And who is to blame? Ben didn't say it. but we can guess. You lot, non-theists. Secular. Where does this word of infection and peril come from? Well, it's been used in a number of different ways, as you'll see if you trawl through a selection of dictionaries. But the Oxford English Dictionary simply defines secular by way of its original meaning as of this world. The word embraces everything that is of this world, the arts, the sciences, nature, the physical elements, the green planet, the blue skies, all things bright and beautiful, all creatures great and small, all human life, our pains and pleasures, our rights and wrongs, our politics, everything, it seems, except religion. And what about secularization? Well, that was coined by George Jacob Holyoake in 1851 to denote a system which seeks to order and interpret life on principles taken solely from this world. Holyoake was a great wordsmith. In the same year, he coined the word non-theism. And you don't need me to define that, or do you? So the emphasis is on this world, but this implies that there is another world, that this is not the only world. Where does that idea come from? It seems to begin, at least in its most coherent form, with Plato and his academy, the world's first university, some 400 years ago, or some 400 years BC. Plato posits the existence of what he calls a world of forms, a pristine region above the surface of the earth, a place beyond the heavens that is more real than the shadow world that we inhabit. In the transcendent world of forms, beauty and truth are more real than the objects that merely imitate or reflect them. The forms are timeless and unchanging, whereas physical things change and decay. Forms are unqualified perfection. Physical things are qualified and conditional. So, two worlds, the shadow and the real, the earthly and the heavenly, the temporal and the timeless. That's Platonic dualism. If you have any questions on Platonism, please don't ask me. Try Wikipedia, like I did. Classical Greek Platonism opened up a new world, literally. Its influence on Christianity is evidence throughout the so-called New Testament, especially in John's Gospel. It's a dualism which permeates Christian hymnology. There is a happy land far, far away. My sins are all forgiven, I'm on my way to heaven. When the saints of earth shall gather over on the other shore, when the roll is called up yonder, I'll be there. How I long to breathe the air of heaven, where pain is gone and mercy fills the streets. It's intoxicating. Set it to a popular tune and it will ring around in your head long after you've realized that it's all nonsense. For two millennia, Christians have embraced this dualism, where this world, the secular world, is but a shadow of the home for little children above the bright blue sky. We are but strangers here. Heaven is our home. And within this mindset, this world, the everyday world in which we live and move and have our being, is an alien world. Yes, we're in it, but we are not of it. Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world, warns the writer of 1 John chapter 2, verse 15. The secular world is an infection, a peril, and we must wear masks and keep our distance, lest we fall prey to its false attractions. It's hardly surprising that friends deeply rooted in Christianity would come to inherit this deep distrust of the secular world, with the inevitable tensions between the contrasting demands of the two worlds pulling in different directions. But to begin with, friends seem to find a way round the contradictions. In the 1650s, they asserted their dual allegiance to the King of Heaven on one hand and the Lord Protector of England on the other, with George Fox urging Cromwell to invade Europe for God's sake, and Margaret Fell praising the New Model Army as the battle axe of the Lord. For that brief period, the two worlds came together. Friends embraced a new heaven and a new earth. The sacred and the secular were joined at the hip. But that changed when the Commonwealth collapsed and the old normality of king, bishops, steeple houses, and arch steeple houses was restored. Friends retreated from the secular world of power politics and declared themselves a peculiar people, particular and distinctive, set apart, strangers in a foreign land. They emphasized their distinctiveness by wearing plain clothes, thee-ing and thou-ing in plain speech, replacing the pagan names of months and days with plain numbers, first month, first day. And most important of all, forbidding marrying out. Quakers lived in the world, but did not consider themselves of the world. They loved not the world, neither the things that were in the world. So secular became a dirty word, an infection to be avoided. This withdrawal from involvement in worldly affairs didn't go entirely unchallenged within the Society of Friends. William Penn, who Samuel Pepys complained had turned Quaker or some such melancholy thing, famously admonished Quakers who kept aloof from the secular world, telling them, "True godliness doesn't turn men out of the world, but enables them to live better in it and excites their endeavours to mend it." Penn's involvement in slavery would later excite endeavours to remove his name from a door in Friend's house. But his encouragement to mend the secular world rather than leaving it in its broken state did eventually bear some fruit. After a slow start, Quakers who generally avoided politics made an exception when it came to the slave trade and campaigned successfully for its abolition, a significant interference in the secular world. Unhappily, however, their undying fear of secular infection encouraged the Society of Friends to steer well clear of any support for the impoverished victims of rapid industrialization at home. Quakers were prominently absent from the working class protests, which led to Peterloo, and the few who ventured to support the Chartist movement were disowned. As one friend wrote, when someone expressed a concern about the absence of working men and women from Quaker meetings, "Do you wish to invite chimney sweeps, costermongers, or blacksmiths to dine on first day?" But there was a price to pay for avoiding secular contamination, and friends discovered the cost a little later in the 19th century, as the society clung doggedly to its old peculiarities. It became clear that sticking with plain dress, plain speech, and a plain calendar led to a catastrophic loss of membership. It was an internal revolt against the prohibition of marrying out of the society that eventually prompted a radical change. In 1859, the rule was abandoned. A Quaker sister could marry a Plymouth brother. A Muggletonian could take a Quaker spouse. A society which had prided itself on its separation from the secular world found that it could only survive by accommodating to the secular world. That accommodation began in Manchester in 1858 with the foundation of the Manchester Friends Institute. 150 friends met together for creative conversations. They talked about science, religion, the arts, politics, and reform. They immersed themselves in the philosophy and politics of John Stuart Mill and European revolutionaries, the essays and poems of Woolman and Whittier, the free thinking of their humanist contemporaries. They dared to listen to Mozart, to read Shakespeare. They abandoned the cloistered silence of the meeting house for boisterous exchanges and hard questioning. Come and join us and have your answers questioned. They were a real nuisance. When their leader, David Duncan, died suddenly of smallpox, the clerk of London Yearly Meeting, Joseph Bevan Braithwaite, wrote in his diary, "How wonderful are the ways of Providence." The Manchester Free Friends planted the seed which flowered into the liberal Quakerism we know today, the Quakerism of Foundations for a New Social Order, published by Yearly Meeting in 1918, and contemporary Quaker involvement in a whole range of humanitarian causes. Quakers today can hardly be accused of excusing themselves from worldly affairs. Rather, to misquote Penn, we seem hell-bent in our endeavours to mend it. I've no doubt that Ben Pink Dandelion, a good friend who I like and respect, fully supports Quaker social action, Quaker peace work, Quaker action on poverty, Quaker involvement in the workings of the secular world. So what are we to make of his concern, shared by many friends, that we are falling prey to the infection of secularism, simply becoming just one more secular pressure group? I think the heart of his concern is that modern friends are losing their traditional belief in that other world, the supposedly more real world of Plato's forms, of the Bible's heaven above, peopled by an almighty God, his cherubim and seraphim, angels and archangels, that happy land far, far away. but that happy land far, far away has been slowly fading, sinking under a rising sea of critical inquiry. And for an increasing number of us, it has become a fairy tale, pie in the sky when you die. Gerard Winstanley, writing in the 1640s, understood this even before he became a Quaker. Quote, "Heaven is not a place above the bright blue sky, but fellowship is a true heaven. Angels are the sparks of glory or heavenly principles set in men. And God? God is neither an external being nor a deified historical Jesus. Christ is not a single man at a distance from you, but the indwelling power of reason. Neither are you to look for God in a place of glory beyond the sun, but within yourself and within every man. He that looks for a God outside himself and worships God at a distance, worships he knows not what, but is deceived by the imagination of his own heart." When George Fox spoke of answering that of God in every man, did he know he was quoting Winstanley? For Winstanley, let's call him the first Quaker non-theist, the old dualism is dead. There is only one world, the natural world, the physical world, the world we see and hear, where we live and move and have our being. If there is another world, a supernatural world, it exists in our creative imagination. A dream, if you like, but an enabling dream, a visionary gleam. It is part of us, part of this world, the secular world. As the title of a Quaker Universalist pamphlet puts it, there is another world, and it is this one. I see the direction of travel in the Religious Society of Friends as a journey from a two-world to a one-world understanding, a shift from the metaphysical to the physical, the supernatural to the natural. You can't help but notice the shift in our language over the past century, gradually less religious and more secular. I was struck by Britain Yearly Meeting's statement this week on Russia's invasion of the Ukraine. Quote, "A grave development for humanity, a violation of international law, including international humanitarian law, the Charter of the United Nations, and the Geneva Conventions which regulate the conduct of war." This is a secular response in secular language. It implicitly recognizes that this is a human problem to be solved by human action rather than hopes or pleas for divine intervention. Does this mean then that we are abandoning our spiritual heritage? I think not. But we need to recognize our spirituality as this-worldly, not otherworldly. A human resource, not a whiff of divine magic. We'll remain a religious society as long as friends want us to call ourselves a religious society. And we'll meet for worship as long as friends choose to call it a meeting for worship. After all, we still call our executive committee meeting for sufferings some three centuries after the persecution of early friends ended. We don't have to bury our history, but we can't be imprisoned by it. Okay, there is another world, but it is this world, secular seculorum.